We like diversity when we go to look at cars. We like diversity when we go shopping for almost anything else. We like the idea of diversity, in fact, in America, when we look at the diverse backgrounds of the peoples who comprise this great country. But when we come to the concept of family, there is one biblical plan for the family, not multiple kinds of families. When we think about this idea of modern family, that presupposes a change from what traditionally was the concept of family. And I don't want to get buried in the discussions whether the age of domesticity in the 1950s and middle-class white culture in America had really fully captured the idea of what the biblical family was. I do want to emphasize, however, the fact that this modern concept of family in the 21st century certainly does not encompass and stick to the biblical concept of what a family is. There have been so many changes that have taken place in this idea of families. And we need to think a little bit about what the nature of these changes are. Just go through the list pretty quickly. Today, we recognize that two-thirds of children live with two parents at any moment in time, that over 40% of children are born outside of marriage, and that cohabiting households now are the fastest growing form of household family situation. Nearly 10% of families are cohabiting families, that is households with two adults and children. That increasingly we have a concept of multicultural families, where we have people who are married from different cultures with different concepts of what family means that comes from those different cultures, and in fact, adopting children that come from those different kinds of cultures and feeling of responsibility to, in some ways, infuse in that family those cultural backgrounds that those children have come from. Increasingly, we have these families that are blended families. Blended due either to the idea of divorce and remarriage, or the idea of people who have created children with some kind of cohabiting relationship with multiple partners, and somehow or another, the idea of grandparents that, two grandparent of one child, now this child is into another family because of divorce and remarriage. We have another set of grandparents, and how, in fact, are those grandparents related to one another vis-a-vis that child? Those kind of blended families due to divorce create some kind of really complicated relationships very frequently. Sometimes I wonder when I encounter people and they're trying to tell me about those relationships, what in fact Thanksgiving looks like when they try and get families together. These are just demographic changes. What perhaps is more significantly important is the changes that take place in terms of the idea of the values that make up a family. Affective individualism is one of the things that very frequently, I think, is affected the way in which we try and understand relationships in America today. Affective individualism. This is a country that was built on individualism, individual values. I like to call that rugged individualism that characterized the pioneers who came to this country and created and carved this country out of a previously kind of undeveloped nation that it was. Rugged individualism, as expressed in what perhaps are still ideas or slogans that you're familiar with, that you stand on your own two feet, that you solve your own problems, that you hoe your own road, that you kill your own snakes. This idea somehow that we are responsible for ourselves. That kind of individualism has given way in America to what is, aptly entitled affective individualism. Individualism in the sense that says, I have a responsibility, first of all, to myself. I have to take care of myself Then I can take care of other people if I have any resources left over. I have a responsibility to live my fullest self in this world. I have a responsibility to be true to myself, even if, in fact, I have to fail in my responsibilities to others to do that. I suspect that you have encountered, hopefully not amongst the members of the church, but you have encountered with your neighbors, that kind of attitude that's a little bit puzzling. And how does that fit with, in fact, marriage and family? Can we, in fact, have a family in which parents take care of the children, spouses take care of one another in the way that they ought to, when they are focused so much on themselves and have this idea that they are supposed to be happy? You ask people, why do you get married? I get married to be happy. They have this sense somehow that if I can marry the right person, that person will make me happy, without thinking that maybe the responsibilities flow both ways and that they should first of all think about whether they can make that person happy. Old German marriage counsel used to say that people shouldn't get married to be happy. If you want to be happy, don't get married. If you want to be happy, don't do that to another person and marry them. If you want to make somebody happy, you can marry them and you could work hard enough to make them happy. And of course, you understand how the marriage is very different if these two people are married, each one of them focused on their sense of, I want to make this other person happy. Vice versa of the idea, both people are thinking about, I want to be happy in this relationship. There are fundamental values that have changed in that fashion in families in America today. One of the things that you would recognize too is that it's a result of these changes in demographics and the changes in values that now people have a variety of different definitions of what they mean by marriage. And I just want to go through some of these quickly before we get to what the Bible has to say about this. The American Academy of Family Physicians describes the family as a group of individuals with a continuing legal, genetic, and or emotional relationship. And of course, then they go ahead to emphasize the social and economic functions of the family. The idea being, of course, that the family is embedded in society and has economic responsibilities. And as society changes and economic responsibilities change, thus the family will change. The US Census defines the family as two or more people, one who is a householder, related by birth, marriage, or adoption, residing in the same housing unit. But then they go ahead to clarify what they really mean by the family, and that is a household is a group of people who live in the same house together, whether they're related or unrelated. All they are talking about is not a family, but a household, people who haven't lived together. Of course, you could ask the question about many of those kinds of arrangements. If you have four people who are living together while they're attending college, four single people living together while they're attending college, does that comprise a family, comprises a household from the point of view of the U.S. Census? National Institute of Mental Health suggests that it is a network of mutual commitment. And of course, there may be some value in thinking of marriage or family as mutual commitment to one another, but network of mutual commitment is so vague as to be really almost useless in the effort to try and define what a family is. The very first time I think that we encountered politically an effort to define what the family was in the Jimmy Carter administration. First Presidential Commission on the Family. And the first thing they did, as they started in general talking about what kind of policies the government should have about various support programs that it would provide for families of various kinds, the very first problem they had is, how do we define what is a family? And in fact, the whole project nearly fell apart on this issue, trying to define what is a family. My whole point about that is to say, people can't define it. then they don't understand what it is and what the mutual obligations are that are part of family relationship. We need to have some agreement about what the family is before we can talk about various practical solutions to the problems that families find. So is there a biblical definition? A biblical definition for the family? And, you know, you can go to your concordances, you can go to your systematic theologies and try to find a definition, book, chapter, and verse, and you won't find one. So I have run the risk of trying to create one. And maybe you'll want to take a look at this, and then as we go through the various passages that contribute to our understanding of the family, see how close you think I've come, or maybe you will say, aha, I think I can write one better. I don't care as long as we're sticking to the scriptures. So this is just a starting point. A set of comprehensive relationships. Decreed at creation and beginning with a monogamous relationship between a man and a woman. It's hierarchical and complementary, and the family provides basic needs and mutual support to the individuals, especially for the children, and connects them to the broader community, both this community today and the community in the future. And in fact, it is responsible thus for propagation, not just the people, but the propagation of spiritual values. So there are a number of things in that. And I think I can go to the scriptures and find passages that indicate that when God talks about the family, he is going to build on these ideas to create this general sort of understanding or definition of the family. Truth of the matter is, when I first started thinking about this, I was a little puzzled that we have to write out a definition for the family and parse it carefully, because everybody should know what something so fundamental as a family is. But like Pilate, who says, what is truth, in order to evade the truth, many people today will ask, what is a family, in order to evade the responsibilities that family relationships place upon them. Once upon a time, everybody would have known what marriage and family was, but the definitions have been stretched in recent times by the innovations of divorce, cohabitation, alternative family forms, that in fact, when Justice Kennedy, in his Obergefell decision, says that marriage includes even the relationship between two people of the same sex, that he can allude to the fact, look at the changes that have taken place. This is just a logical next step. And I have to agree with him about that. If you've given up on the issue of divorce, if you've given up on the issue of cohabitation, if you've given up on the issue of a lifetime relationship with one another, if you've given up on the relationship that is monogamous and is based on God's word, then ultimately, I don't know how you avoid including same-sex marriage. But by the same token, if you can include that, then what can you exclude from what's a marriage relationship? And I guarantee you that the next steps are going to be even more tawdry and even more amazing than the idea of same-sex marriages. Despite all this, it's still important to people. They still want to know and want to talk about and understand the importance of marriage. And so they have, their own kind of take on that. And I think some modern examples of people kind of casually defining what marriage is would give us some sense of the way in which our society thinks about it. Marriage is just a promise you make, and you do your best not to break that promise. And of course, there is some value to that. You ought to try and keep your promises, but marriage is something more than a promise. Or from a movie, Your life will not go unnoticed because I will notice it. Your life will not go unwitnessed because I will be your witness. And no matter how romantic that might sound to us in some moments in our life, and no matter how important it may be to us that we're the center of somebody else's attention, that's not really what marriage is all about. Or what about this idea marriage is just a piece of paper? Why do we clutter up what we have with that piece of paper? Somehow the sense that obligations decrease the value of the relationship, the love that a man and a woman might have for one another, seems to have taken hold in our society today. Marriage is your heart finding a home. Well, family, home, marriage, those things certainly go together. But my suspicion is when people say marriage is your heart finding a home, they're thinking in this affective individualism kind of mode in which they're thinking about the benefits that are going to accrue to them rather than the obligations that they're undertaking. Marriage is a 50-50 partnership. Well, that sounds really good, except, of course, you know that people say that in order to avoid the hierarchical relationships that God has established in Scripture that are a part of marriage. They're saying it's a partnership in the sense that they think they understand what business partnerships are, and somehow that would help us understand what marriage relationship is. That's not the way the Bible talks about it. Whatever value these kinds of definitions might have, that there were two of those. Whatever kind of value these definitions may have, and each one of them, I think, has some significance and has some value. They are not what the Bible asserts that marriage is. In fact, truth of the matter is, in the most postmodern society in which we live, people are almost willing to say, well, you can't even define what marriage is. You can't even define what a family is. They will talk about the fact of your definition as if somehow your definition and my definition are a matter of independent determination, and there is no way in which we could arrive at an agreed upon specific definition that everybody has to adhere to. Your definition of marriage. Everybody has the right to their own idea about what a marriage is. And of course, that's the sign of the time in which we live. We all are entitled to find our true authentic self. We're all entitled to find our own true authentic relationships. That's not what the Bible talks about. Marriage, like Scripture, from a biblical point of view, is not a matter of individual interpretation. It was given to us by God at creation, regulated by God through both covenants. And it is not a matter of our own individual interpretation of what we want our marriage to be like. You know, one of the signs of this, I think, is the fact that so many people these days are writing their own marriage vows. And of course, there's, you know, nothing wrong with a couple having some specific words that they want to say to one another in the context of that marriage ceremony. But if they think that those individualized words are capturing the nature and the essence of the marriage you're going to have, are substituting for the kind of marriage that God intended, then they're much mistaken about that. Marriage is not a matter of individual taste. It is something that God has ordained, and we ought to be able to go through the Scriptures and find out exactly what it is. Truth of the matter is, human nature has not changed since creation. Despite the progressive ideas that we have made some kind of progress and we are somehow better people today than the people of the past were, that's just not the case. You look at the widely separated examples the Scripture gives us of Abraham at 1400 BC and the first century, and the people and the characteristics of their decisions and their emotions and their personality are essentially the same. We are essentially the same as they were in the first century, as they were at creation. Human nature has not changed. And God certainly has not changed. God is immutable and unchangeable, and his laws, his moral laws, have not changed, nor has his prescription for what we are in relationship to one another in a family. Biblical marriage has not changed. Okay, so I gave you a definition that I said was based on the Bible. And I have broadly discussed and contrasted that with what society thinks that it is. Let's go to the scriptures, the most important part of the lesson, and see if we can ascertain what the Bible says about marriage and family, and if, in fact, that matches up with what I have defined as being based, I hope, on those passages. First of all, I want to say, as we talk about these characteristics of marriage, that marriage is a covenant relationship. And that word covenant is key and significantly important. Malachi chapter 2 and verse 14, one of the last words in the old covenant before the new covenant. Malachi 2 and verse 14, God says to the people of Israel, I have this against you. I am a witness against you, between you and the wife of your youth, against whom you have dealt treacherously, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. And that's not just true of those post-exilic Jews, that marriage was a covenant relationship. It had always been a covenant relationship. And what that means, this is not just a legal contract drawn up by two people and by the state. It's more than a legal commitment. It is a sacred moral commitment. Contracts suggest that the party in the first part and the party in the second part stipulate that each of these two parties will engage in these specific kind of activities. And if, in fact, these specific activities are failed, then these specific penalties are going to apply. And in fact, if you have signed a contract and it turns out that you don't want to conclude that contract and fulfill the stipulations, if you pay the penalties that are stipulated in that contract, then that's okay. The ethical obligations have been taken care of. A contract also suggests that if the party in the first part fails in their duties, the party in the second part is released from the contract. So many people think that's the case with marriage, that in fact, if the party in the first part, the husband or the wife, doesn't do what the party in the second part thinks they ought to do, that somehow they're released from their obligations and their promises in the marriage relationship. That's just not true. It's a covenant, not a contract. A covenant means, in fact, that we have pledged to the other person, no matter what, I'm going to do these things. I'm going to fulfill these obligations to you, no matter what. And that's what the marriage vows say, right? That in sickness or health, for better or worse, wealth or poverty. And as I like to say, that's not multiple choice. Regardless of what happens in that relationship, regardless of whether their health is maintained or their beauty is maintained or their wealth is maintained, you have pledged to them. Whatever it is that you have pledged in a marriage relationship is your obligation regardless. And of course, lots of people in our day and age say, well, that's unfair. You know, if they haven't kept their health up, or if they haven't kept the kind of job that they had when I married them, or if they haven't maintained their love for me, that somehow I am released from those obligations. No, it is a covenant pledge, and you have that obligation regardless of what they do. People say that's unfair. Well, as the knight said to Indiana Jones, choose wisely. Choose wisely before you pledge to someone else in a marriage relationship. It is a covenant relationship in the sense that it involves God. It involves God in, we read in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 6, so they are no longer two but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. And of course, let no man separate would mean that neither of the two partners in the marriage relationship could divide that marriage apart, nor could some kind of a third party, no matter what its legal kind of status would be, is able to separate those two people from one another. They are one flesh, and of course that would suggest something about the physical nature of the relationship, but it suggests more than that. It suggests where there was once one, now there are two, and they can't be separated because God has joined them together. The contract can be broken by the one party, but the covenant cannot be broken by the one party. If in fact we, if in fact we have made this pledge to one another in the presence of God, then it doesn't matter what man does, whether they've witnessed it or whether they've written some kind of legal contract, or whether the state decides that these are causes for divorce, or these are ways in which the marriage can be broken. It doesn't matter because it's God who has joined them together. It also means that it's not just some temporary kind of, sort of emotional attachment between the two persons, that we are participating fully in this marriage relationship. That if we were participating partly on the basis of, I'm giving you this much of my time, I'm giving you this much of my emotional commitment, that would really be a marriage in the way in which God has seen the marriage relationship. It's a comprehensive relationship that extends every aspect of who we are. That's why in the marriage vows that traditionally are written, the husband will talk about, endowing his wife with all his earthly possessions. It's why, in fact, the sense of the state has in the past been that a husband and a wife have equal rights to the property or the assets of either one of the partners to the marriage. Why, in fact, they have equal obligation to the debts of one another. Choose wisely when you choose to join with someone else in a marriage relationship. It means, in fact, that when one is happy, well off, the other one is happy and well off because that's the person to whom they have committed themselves. They can't be happy unless the other person is happy. They can't be well off unless the other person is happy. They have pledged themselves to one another. It's not just a personal relationship, as some people like to think of it these days. Not just a personal relationship, no matter how comfortable it may be or how uncomfortable it may be, that has nothing to do with whether it is a marriage relationship. In John chapter 4, Jesus, in a discussion with the woman at the well, says to her, "Go and call your husband and come here." And the woman answered him with a perspicacity that I'm amazed at. And she says, "I have no husband." And Jesus says to her, "You have correctly said, I have no husband, for you have had five husbands. And the one whom you now have is not your husband. This you have said truly." Of course, Bible students for centuries have wished they knew everything about this woman's background so we could maybe interpret some of the aspects of the statement. But what Jesus has said, the husband that you have now, the one that other people would look at and say is your husband, is not really your husband. And I have no idea what that relationship was like. It could have been perfectly comfortable relationship. They could have been perfectly happy with one another. The neighbors could have looked at them and thought, this is a really good relationship. They could have thought, this is certainly a marriage. And yet Jesus says it is not, because a marriage is a covenant relationship in which God has joined two people together, not a matter of some personal agreement between two individuals. Furthermore, it is a monogamous relationship between a man and a woman. That's from the very beginning. We are male and female. God said in the very beginning, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish and the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. I don't want to get off on environmentalism. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And it is clear that we are male and female. People come in those two varieties, equally in the image of God, but some are male and some are female. Every single cell in your body knows whether you're male or female. The genetics of it are really not all that critically important. What is important is what the scriptures say about that. He made us male or female. Yes, there are probably about 0.2% of the population in which there is some kind of genetic abnormality in the chromosomal pattern. Even among those, half of those still produce either ovum, eggs, or sperm to fertilize the eggs. There is no he, she, gene, as the young people seem to think and even ask sometimes. We are male or female biologically. And whatever society may want to do about that and confuse us about that, and they are really good at confusing young people about whether they're male or female or they, them, whatever society does about that does not change the fundamental fact that God said that he created us male and female. And having created us male and female, he said, for this cause, a man shall leave his father and his mother, and he'll cleave to his wife, and the two shall be one flesh. And in fact, he's given us different roles in those relationships. Boys are going to have certain responsibilities when they grow up to be husbands. Girls are going to have certain other responsibilities when they grow up to be wives. Those things were clearly taught in scripture, and it doesn't matter whether we have in our society an unwillingness to train the boys and the girls for those roles, and thus they're inadequate for them when they get married. It is, in fact, God's plan that male and female should marry and create a family. There is this monogamous relationship that we have. And creation reveals this monogamy to us. Creation teaches us God's view about man and woman. There's male and there's female. And we should, in fact, and do marry one man and one woman. And in fact, in creation, it is interesting to observe God created Adam. Then he created the woman, Eve, to be a helpmeet for him. He created one woman for one man. He didn't create a spare woman just in case Adam didn't like the one woman that he gave to her, first of all. One man, one woman, no spares, no options. That's it. That's what God has intended. And that's what he intends for marriage today. And in fact, you know, we have this kind of personal preference in the world today because there are multiple men and multiple women. And we choose, have the right to choose individually as to whether we'll marry this one or that one or the other one. If we come to some kind of agreement that we choose this person and this person chooses us, we have that right. But once we have that right, once we have exercised that right, then there's an obligation to one another. There is, in fact, going to be no such thing as divorce. God intends for the man and the woman to marry one another and to be married to one another until death does them part. And Matthew chapter 19, of course, Jesus is asking this question, what about divorce? And he answers them significantly by going back to the creation event. He is not going to embed the question about marriage and divorce in societal norms. He's not going to embed the answer to the question about marriage and divorce into some kind of changing circumstances. He embeds it into creation. For this reason, he said, God made you male and female. For this reason, a man would leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, two shall become one flesh, no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. And of course, we may deal with all kinds of questions about at what point does God actually join this man and this woman together? There's a leaving, there's a cleaving, there's a one flesh relationship. But at some point, it's clear that God has joined this man and this woman together. And he expects them to stay together. Choose wisely. One of the things to recognize too is that this monogamous relationship is emphasized in commandments that God gave to the family of Abraham, his people under the old covenant, as we call it, the first covenant, when he called them together, gave them those 10 commandments that kind of covered in a general way what he expected of them. And as you recognize, the first four of those commandments pertain to our relationship to God. The six that come after pertain to human relationships. And of these six, three of them have considerations about the family involved in them. So in fact, when God creates this covenant with his people, a part of that is the covenant of marriage and family and his plan for that. In the fifth commandment, for instance, the fifth commandment is to honor your father and your mother. And when God says, honor your father and your mother, he does not say, honor your fathers and your mothers. He is talking about a monogamous relationship in which there's one father and there's one mother. Polygamous societies existed all over the world at that point in time. In fact, that's one of the things that God warned them against when they went into the land of Canaan. But God says specifically, honor your father and your mother. He expects us to have this kind of monogamous sort of relationship. A nation as promiscuous as the one in which we live today leaves children with considerable doubt, perhaps, about who is their father and who is their mother. One of the things that we have observed about divorce and remarriage, where there are children involved, is sometimes the child, presuming it's the mother who has kept the child and has remarried, the child sometimes will deny that they have any father because the father that was their biological father has left and is no longer a father, and that the new man that the wife, their mother has married, doesn't seem like a father either, and they have no father. Sometimes they will cling to the old father, the biological father, and reject the new one. Sometimes, of course, they may think, I have two fathers. I have the biological father who gives me lots of good gifts on certain holidays, and I have this new stepfather who takes care of me on a day-to-day basis. Or sometimes they will choose just a new stepfather and reject the biological. But that's not what God intended. That kind of complexity is a sign of sin. God expects monogamous relationships and expects children to be able to look and to say, my father and my mother, and honor them as is appropriate. The seventh commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, preserves the covenant relationship between the man and the woman and secures the family. One of the things that has, I think, developed in the modern society in which we live is a sense that religious people are in some ways puritanical or prudish about sexual activities. And I think in some ways it's a result of the fact that the modern world has lost the biblical foundation of understanding the importance of the man woman relationship, a one flesh relationship that God has intended in marriage and nowhere else. And clearly the seventh commandment, you know, we're talking about 10 commandments that God gave. And of those 10 commandments, one of them is honor your father and mother. And another one is thou shalt not commit adultery. Is it significantly important to him that his people should understand about this monogamous nature of the relationship? And it has enormous benefits for the husband and the wife and for the child. Remember this comedian many years ago? You know, he walked, said, I came home, walked in the door, and my kids came running up and they said, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy. And I believe them. He believes in his wife because he chose a wife who is faithful to him because she's faithful to God and she understands about the covenant relationship. We need that kind of security in this most intense and important relationship in our life. You think about this. What happens to society if children are born outside of marriage relationships? Remember the number I put up earlier, 40% of children in America today are born outside of a marriage relationship. Absolutely startling number. In the 1950s, sociologists looked at certain subsets of the culture in America, and they said, this is a terrible situation in the inner cities where 30% of the children are born outside of marriage. And now it's 40% of every child, of all the children in America, who are born outside of marriage. They're not raised in the context of knowing who their mother and their father are. They're not raised in the context of the kind of security that a monogamous, faithful marriage relationship provides for them. And what you see is the kind of social disruption that we find in America today. Of those men who are in prison in America today, over 1 million men that are in prison for violent crimes, overwhelmingly they come from foster homes, not from intact two-parent homes. Intact two-parent homes do not produce children who commit violence against other people. If we wanted to solve some of the problems that exist in America today, we would get right back to these biblical principles about marriage. Well, maybe you're okay with those, and then it comes to this fact that family is hierarchical, that there is a hierarchical relationship in the family. And of course, when we talk about the hierarchical relationship in the family, that's the point at which many people want to leave the biblical prescriptions for marriage and take off on their own kind of trajectory. It is one of the most contentious issues probably in America today, the relationship between men and women, and the presumption that in some ways the Bible has relegated women to second-class citizenship. I don't know about second-class citizenship, but I do know that the Bible talks about the hierarchical nature of the relationship, and in such a context that it is impossible for us to just kind of pass it off as something that's by the way. Because in Ephesians chapter 5, the Apostle Paul is talking about the church. That's what the book of Ephesians is about. In Ephesians chapter 5, he said, wives are to be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church. He himself being a savior in the body, but as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. Nevertheless, each individual among you also is to love his own wife, even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she respects her husband. Sometimes we've asked the question when we read this passage, is Jesus talking here about the relationship between the man and the woman to help us understand the relationship between Christ and the church? Or is he talking about the relationship between Christ and the church in order to help us understand the relationship between the man and the woman? Well, at creation, at the foundation of the world, God already knew what the plan of salvation was going to be. And his plan for the family interrelates with his plan of salvation so that, in fact, it's not a matter of which came first and which of these is used to illustrate the other. These two things are a part of God's plan for us. The plan of salvation, the plan of the family, really in some ways interact with one another, and certainly in this point. And what we learn from this hierarchical relationship, whether we like it or not, is in fact the idea that the man must love his wife as Christ loved the church. And the wife is to create, treat her husband as the head in the same way that the church treats Christ as the head. And of course, you know, there are those people who, you know, will try every kind of dodge to get out of the obvious meaning of passages like this. They'll look at the Greek word and they'll say, well, it means something more like source as opposed to the head. As in terms of a ruler, it means more like somebody who is, you know, flowing together with the other person. I don't care, you know, what the Greek words mean or what kind of etymology you look at. It's pretty clear that Christ is the head of the church and the church is going to have to be obedient to Christ. And of course, that means that the wife has to be obedient to the husband. And of course, you know, that seems maybe unfair and might be unfair. Choose wisely before you make that kind of commitment. Choose wisely. And understand this too, I think, from this passage, because sometimes people get confused about what responsibilities. It's not the man's responsibility to ensure his wife's submission. Then it isn't the wife's responsibility to ensure her husband's love. Sometimes, you know, husbands will try and think about, you know, how can I get my wife to be more obedient and do what I want her to do? That's not really his responsibility. And very frequently, I guarantee you this, the women talk with one another, how can you make your wife, your husband love you? That's not their responsibility either. No, wife's responsibility is to respect her husband, not to undermine him, not to manipulate him, not to in some way subvert his authority or weaken him in his life, but to respect him in the same way the church respects Christ who is the head. And it is the husband's responsibility to love his wife with the same fervor that Christ loved the church, willing to die on the cross for it. That's the husband's responsibility. It may be hard, I think, to understand the relationship between the husband and the wife in a vacuum. But in the context in which God places it, it certainly makes sense. And I would say to you that this, you know, exhibits a requirement of equal unselfishness on the part of the wife and the husband. The women may think this is an inferior position and somehow intolerable that I have to do what my husband tells me to do. But it may also be an intolerable position that the husband has to sacrifice everything that he is for his wife. That's what God requires of us in a marriage relationship. We don't get married to use the other person. We get married to offer ourselves and the other person's service. And God's plan protects both in this marriage relationship. We ought not to enter this relationship easily. Before marriage, if you're not married yet, and you're contemplating that, the wife has to ask herself, wife to be, has to ask herself, do I love this man enough to live for him? And the husband has to ask, do I love this woman enough to die? And of course, most men, you know, it's like, yeah, I would step in front of the bullet for her. I would jump in front of the car and throw her out of the way and die for her. That's the easy part. Are you willing to die second by second, life, blood, drop by life, blood, drop for her for the rest of your life? Are you willing to give up your friends and give up your personal pursuits for her? That's what God has asked. Now, if you're already married, here's the question you have to ask yourself. The wife has to ask herself, now, how can I live for my husband? What can I do for him to show my respect? And the husband has to ask himself, what kind of sacrifices can I make for my wife that will make her more secure and make her happy? Those are tough questions to ask, but that's what God expects out of a marriage relationship. One of the things that we may recognize too about marriage and family is it involves generational responsibilities. Generational responsibilities between the parents and the children. The modern family, in some ways, just based on a marriage contract between two consenting adults. And as the parents often say to their children, when they see their children choosing someone to marry, you have to choose them. You're the one who has to live with them. I don't have to live with them. And I can tell you this, you do have to live with them. When your children marry, those spouses now become yours and your responsibility. Unless you're willing to just completely write off your own children. And the truth of the matter is, when your son marries a woman, her parents somehow become related to you. Just figure that one out. You have a vested interest in who they marry. And of course, you know, we don't want to revert in the time in which we live today. We don't want to revert back to the, you know, contractual marriages, but you do have a vested interest. In fact, we have a generational responsibility to our children and our grandchildren, and we need to understand that generational responsibility. God holds us responsible in some ways for the future generations and for our children. Passages that somehow get distorted pretty easily, like Exodus 34, verse 7, God says he'll visit the iniquity of fathers upon their children, upon the children's children, and the third and the fourth generation. There are a lot of complications about passage. I can see in my children today, especially as they deal with their children, I can see my mistakes that are just carried on into the next generation. We need to live our lives when we marry and have children in such a way as we recognize that what we do has repercussions to the third and the fourth generation. It was one of the things that God warned them about when they went into the land of Canaan and said, don't intermarry with those people, because he understood that when you bring those kinds of cultures and those kinds of values into your own homes, they're going to have repercussions on your children and on your grandchildren and even to the third and the fourth generation. We have a responsibility to that generation. We have a responsibility to pass on the faith. That's a part of what God intended for the family. I began by saying that there's nothing of more practical importance to us other than the plan of salvation, except the practical implications of the plan for the family. But these two things are related together. That's what God intended. You should raise your children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord, that we have this responsibility to teach the children so that they can teach the generations not yet born about God and learn to put their confidence in God. So one of the great failings of Israel is they forgot the blessings of the law. It only takes three generations for the faith to be lost completely. When the first generation fails to teach the second generation, sometimes they carry on just by habit, but they don't know what to teach to the third generation. They have nothing to pass on to them, and the faith is completely lost. We have, when we marry, that responsibility. I am reminded of what Paul said to Timothy in 2 Timothy 1 and verse 5. I'm mindful of the sincere faith which first dwelt in your grandmother, Lois, and your mother, Eunice, and now I'm sure is in you as well. God bless us that we can make families and raise children so that those same kinds of blessings can be extended from this generation to the next generation and the next generation to the third and the fourth generation. That's what God intends for you. Well, there's some other things that I would like to talk to you about, the different roles, husbands and wives, children, parents, but the time has passed us by. as I was afraid it would. But hopefully we can talk about some of those things as we move into some of the more practical lessons as we move on through this series of lessons. I think, well, we have almost on is an invitation, so. Okay. Well, I would say this, I said, you know, God has a plan for family and he has a plan for your salvation. You need to adhere to his plan for family. You certainly need to listen to his plan of salvation. And I'm sure there are those here, if you want to hear more about that this evening or some other occasion, we'll be more than happy, as I would, to talk to you about the plan of salvation. But let's sing the song and then we'll take a break and we'll get some questions.
I'm going to turn in the supplemental book. Supplemental songbooks number 202. If you have had a chance to fill out any questions, as Luke said, we can't promise every question will be answered, but we'll do our best. Go ahead and pass those to the middle, and I think Luke and Will and Jacob actually are going to select those, and then we'll go from there. Number 202 in the folder in the supplemental songbook, the spiral bound one. It's all same.
Cristo nombre precioso
we're going to take a quick break just for a few minutes. If you have a question, go ahead and pass it to the sender. I'll collect it and look at it. And we'll be back here in about 4 or 5 minutes for him to answer the questions. Then we'll have a prayer and be done. So if you want to take a quick 5 minute break, yes. Okay, well, we're taking a break. Okay. Our translator, sorry. Okay, so if you have a question, that you'd like me to get, just hold it up and I'll get it. Want to get a drink of water? Do that too. I'm going to go to the next one.
That would be good.
Good, thank you. Okay, we can't get all the questions in, and but we have four here that you can address. The first one, just randomly, what you need to use the microphone. You have a microphone. Okay. Okay. What does it look like to teach young people the values of a proper marriage?
What does it look like? Beautiful. I think the question probably is practical things. And of course, as we sometimes say about teaching children, your words are maybe helpful, but your example is much more useful. In fact, Schweitzer said the only way to teach is by example. So I think what they see in the relationship between their parents is going to have more of an impression on them than any of the words that you'll ever say to them. It's helpful, of course, to explain to them that this relationship that they see is embedded in biblical concepts. You can't, use words to teach them that. But I think, the passing on to the next generation proper marriage relationships is done by living it before them for years, and it becomes a part of who they are.
Okay. Now here's a question. When adultery happens, who is breaking the marriage? Is it God or is it the unfaithful person?
Well, I think it's clear that God has joined them together